find oral arguments, and we'll take the case under advisement. We'll turn now to the last case of the morning, number 033034, the United States against Tyrus McNair. Mr. Robinson.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matt Robinson on behalf of the appellant Tyrus McNair. Your Honors, I'd like to first start this out by setting the context of the appeal that we're presenting. Mr. McNair is a first-time nonviolent drug offender who ended up with a sentence of 360 months. He has five children that won't see him until he's out of jail 30 years from now. Now, with regard to that, we're raising a few issues in the appeal. First and foremost is the right to a speedy trial, which Mr. McNair requested through counsel at the district court. Essentially, what was found at the district court was that there was a delay of 97 days, which went beyond the speedy trial clock of 70 days, as you well know. The government makes many, and the district court takes issue with the reasonableness of the delay. Clearly there was a delay, and the issue is whether that delay was reasonable under these circumstances. We are very aware that there are delays that have been longer. However, as we pointed out, each case is different. And as trial counsel pointed out, each case is different, and each case needs to be reviewed under the facts of those cases.
But in this case, the district court was keeping close tabs on how long it was taking to locate and apprehend Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And after the second status conference, it turns out they actually do get him, and so that's why things stop. It seems to me if reasonableness is the touchstone and we should give some deference to the district court's handling of what's a reasonable time, the 97 days, I don't know what this section of the Speedy Trial Act would mean if it excluded this particular situation.
Well, I agree to a point with Your Honor. However, under these circumstances, Mr. McNair was asserting his right to speedy trial. He wanted to go to trial as soon as possible. As I pointed out, he had a very limited criminal history, which was limited only to traffic citations, essentially.
But when you say his right to a speedy trial, that is qualified by H7, which is getting all the defendants together in a multiple defendant case. And I certainly agree with you. I mean, it's right on the ball trying to keep this in front of the district court. But for all I know, if Mr. Streeter hadn't been apprehended in early May, perhaps they would have said, well, now that's long enough, we have to move forward.
Perhaps they would have. However, that didn't happen. You know, he was apprehended, and the trial did move forward eventually. However, under these circumstances, the delay was not reasonable in the sense that the defendant was moving for a speedy trial. The trial did not, obviously, the courts would prefer to try defendants together for judicial autonomy and to try to move the court system along. However, the fact remains is Mr. Streeter did not need to be apprehended and did not need to be tried with Mr. McNair for this trial to move forward.
Was there any thought ever to moving to sever?
That I can't answer because I wasn't trial counsel. However, I would point this out. I believe that if, you know, and this is cited in a few of the cases as reasons that the delay was reasonable in the cases that the government has cited. However, it seemed to me that if you moved to sever the case, that would stop the trial, the speedy trial clock, which would circumvent his right to the right that he was trying to assert, which was, I want to go to trial right now. Moving on to prejudice, that's another issue that the government takes issue with. There's no issue of the defendant showing prejudice of the appellant, excuse me. The point remains is at the time this motion was made, he was presumed innocent. And again, that's why I brought up the fact that he is basically a first-time nonviolent drug offender who's being held waiting to go to trial. He has children. He has a wife, or at least common-law wife. And, you know, under those circumstances, you know, pretrial confinement, minimizing the anxiety of the accused, limiting the possibility of a defense, all those things come into play. And another thing that's interesting is Streeter ultimately pled guilty and was the key witness in this case against Mr. McNair. Had Mr. McNair moved forward without Streeter being arrested, pleading guilty, cooperating in exchange for a 108-month sentence, you know, a lot of the whole the trial would have been vastly different.
And it would, although ironically that argument does suggest that the government had a rather powerful reason to try to get both of the defendants moving forward at the same time.
Well, yes, I understand your point, of course, but the fact remains is the government did not know, I'm assuming at that time, that Mr. Streeter was going to be willing to plead guilty. Of course,
they can always hope, right?
Well, they can always hope, and they do hold, you know, 5K1 and 3553 over those defendants. And of course, you know, I can think of no, you know, and this kind of dovetails into credibility of witness testimony and everything else that we're talking about in our brief with regard to the other issues. And I can think of nothing more valuable to someone than freedom. And essentially, you know, a lot of these people are would be willing to, you know, sell out their own mothers if they're going to be able to, instead of receiving a 30-year sentence, get out in 10 years or 8 years. This is a very, you know, it's more of a philosophical question, but it's something that I think goes to the credibility of our district court findings in criminal cases, especially drug cases. Now, as far as, and I'll quickly move on to the other issues, as far as leadership role goes, we raise this in two ways, one in a very straightforward way, and the other way kind of a novel issue, and obviously the leadership role essentially is what the bottom line to this issue is, that there was not sufficient credible evidence on the record that Mr. McNair actually controlled other culpable participants in this offense. I realize the district court made findings that he would pay money or wire money to people at times, but I don't think that suggests control. It suggests a network of individuals working together. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will save the rest for the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. So we'll hear now from Ms. King.
Thank you. May it please the court, Levita Morris King on behalf of the United States, the appellee. I was not trial counsel below, but I will attempt to address some of the issues raised by counsel here today. First, with respect to the speedy trial issue, the 97 days clearly was reasonable in an effort to join multiple defendants, and that being the two here, McNair and Streeter. The magistrate court below made an attempt and did in fact have two status conference hearings to ascertain the status or the whereabouts of co-defendant Streeter. I believe those hearings were held on March 6th of 2002 and April 26th of 2002.
Ms. King, are there any objective criteria we should look to decide what things fall within the realm of reasonableness for H7 purposes and what things don't, or is this just kind of a seat of the pants? How many months was it, or what is it?
Your Honor, I don't believe there is a set of specific factors that I found in the research. However, there is in this record from the magistrate court conference, status conference, the trial prosecutor's notation that law enforcement was actively looking for Mr. Streeter, and I believe that is a factor that the magistrate court, the district court, as well as this court, should consider in determining whether the delay was reasonable.
You mean that sort of diligence on the part of the government is an appropriate point?
Yes, Your Honor. The excludable time, the 97 days, again, was reasonable. There was no motion to sever filed by, as this court is aware, Mr. McNair. I don't even believe there was a reference to filing a motion to sever by the appellant.
He seemed to be making the argument this morning that there was a concern that filing such a motion might have the undesirable effect of actually lengthening the time rather than shortening it, perhaps because of the time during which the district court would have it under advisement or something. I'm not really sure quite what that is, but
I'm not sure if I followed counsel's comment with regard to that, just at a first blush, so I would disagree. But we can't really address that in this case because he did not file a motion to sever for us to even have considered at the lower court, let alone at this level. Mr. McNair has not shown where there's been any prejudice to him to prevent his ability to present a defense in this case. I would add, I believe counsel indicated that this may have been his first time nonviolent offender. I just would point out to the court that the defendant McNair did have a criminal history category of 2, so there is some type of criminal history that he did have.
Wasn't that for little things like driving without ever having received a driver's license or some odd things that were putting him in that category?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have that directly before me at this time.
I think so, yeah.
With reference to his leadership role, the record is quite clear from the testimony of some of the co-conspirators or people involved in this conspiracy that he recruited other individuals, relatives, associates, that he paid the drug couriers for these multiple trips to and from Fort Wayne to California, vice versa, that there was evidence of wire transfer, so we're not looking just at the testimony alone of these people involved in this conspiracy. There is some documentation to support some of that testimony. There's evidence in the record that Mr. McNair was the one who had contact with the source between Mr. Streeter, the source, and Mr. McNair. The evidence also showed that it was Mr. McNair who received the bulk of the profits in this conspiracy. True, the couriers were paid some type of fee for their participation, but again, it was Mr. McNair who received the bulk of that profit. Mr. McNair purchased vehicles that were used during the time of this conspiracy. This was an extensive, long-term type conspiracy beginning from 1996, continuing on to 2001. And clearly, the record shows us that there were at least 5 individuals involved. And I believe the district court made reference to 15 named individuals that appeared repeatedly throughout the record. I do want to just touch on the determination of the amount of drugs attributable to Mr. McNair, although I don't think at this point it was addressed by counsel during his opening. He may address it during his rebuttal, I'm not sure. But clearly the Texas stop alone was sufficient in quantity to determine the defendant's base level of 36. Just the Texas stop alone. If we were to look at the other drug trips committed by the co-conspirators during this time frame of the conspiracy, and coupled with the cash seizures that we converted to a drug quantity, clearly it falls within the base offense level of 36.
How much was he charged with?
5 kilograms, more than 5 kilograms. And I believe once that conversion was done, that put it in the middle for the, once the conversion was converted to, once the drugs were converted to marijuana, it put it almost squarely in the middle of the range at base level 36. Lastly, when we look at the constitutional, whether there were any constitutional errors, there were not. There were none. It is well established in this circuit that all that is required is the evidence to be evaluated by proponents of the evidence, and the court did that here. Counsel also referenced in his brief that drug quantity is an element of the offense, and it is not. The counsel even brought up the fact in his brief that the drug quantities were relevant conduct, and again, those other drug quantities were not. Talking about the other trips or the cash seizures, those were quantities of drugs during the time frame of the conspiracy, so clearly they were not relevant conduct. Does the court have any questions at this time? If not, I will thank the court for its time and ask that the court affirm the decision of the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. King. We have 2 minutes, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you. Just to address that question posed by Your Honor, yes, the defendant does have the appellant does have a criminal history category 2 that was based on a slew of driving without license offenses, and it's in the early 90s when the appellant was around 20 years old. He initially got a 180-day sentence that was suspended and then revoked, and that's how he got that criminal history. As far as the other points, clearly, first of all, I would assert that under these circumstances, Apprendi and the cases following that out of the Seventh Circuit, that hasn't been violated. Okay, I'm not saying that. More or less what I'm saying is the way the guidelines work in this situation, first of all, the leadership enhancement, for example, if the government thought Mr. McNair was a leader of a criminal enterprise as large as they went on to push for it to be at sentencing, shouldn't he have been charged with CCE, where leadership role would be an element of the offense? There's some inherent problems with the way the evidence is presented and the fact that this case essentially is based upon co-defendants who have pled guilty and testified against Mr. McNair. There was not any indication of physical evidence of Mr. McNair dealing directly with the drugs that were alleged in the PSI and at sentencing. And finally, these drug amounts, the leadership role enhancement, those are all made at sentencing by preponderance of the evidence, true. But there's a problem with that. There's no rules of evidence at sentencing. Many things come in at sentencing that would never ever come in at trial. And the government knows that when they charge someone. And they know that once 5 kilograms is established, that they can get a much higher sentence at sentencing simply by bringing up more uncredible statements by co-defendants who have pled guilty that the district,
Well, Mr. Robinson, you can save this for the Supreme Court, which certainly may wish to take it up at some point as they're paying attention, but I'm afraid a lot of these reasonable arguments are foreclosed to you in the circuit, which I'm sure you know.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. We thank both Mr. Robinson and Ms. King for their presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement. Today's call is completed, so the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow morning.